In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God, Amen. It's an honor to be with you tonight. Thank you so much for being here and for inviting me. And just before I start, I'd like to set the record straight. I had nothing to do with Matt, how he turned out. You know, and I'm really sorry that you had to deal with him for the past 3 years.
You did what you could.
I did what I could. I tried my best. But please, I'm not claiming any personal responsibilities on the, you know, the way he's conducted himself here in Harvard School and amongst his colleagues. So, you know, there is an exception to every rule. But usually, whenever you see a Coptic student, you know, he or she would be like a good example to what the church is. So you have to judge how he turned to be, but no, Matt is a great friend of mine and known him for a long, long time. Our topic for tonight is love of God, love of neighbor. And I thought to myself here, coming to the place where great minds meet, you know, the cream of the crop, right? And I mean, if I give you any problem to solve, you'll do just like that. You have no problem whatsoever, okay? So I'm going to test your intelligence a little bit, okay? There are no tricks here. I'm just going to show you a little statement. And I'm sure most of you are in law school or some other majors. Okay, most are law school. But like, at least you'd know how to count up to 10. Is that true? Like, I mean, that's not like a major. Yeah, I think most of us have no problem doing that. So let me give you just a little sentence to read. So we'll go to the next slide. And all you need to do is just to count in this passage here how many letter Fs. F as in Frank. Okay. So starting from the word fairness. So I just want to ask you not to speak to anyone who's beside you. Okay, I'll go out of the way. The sentence starts at fairness is the final result of years of effective effort combined with the experience of diversity. So all I ask you to do is, and don't yell out the answer, please just keep it in your mind. I'm going to ask you some questions in it. Do you have it? Is it? Are you done? Okay, just review one more time, please. Look at it one more time and count how many letter Fs is in this sentence. Done? Positive? Okay. No tricks here. How many C? 5 Fs. Yeah, a total, like just in this sentence here. How many see a total of 5 Fs? Nobody. How about 6? 6? 2 people see 6? Okay, how many see 7? How many see 8? 2, 3. How many see 9? Okay, how many see 10? Okay, so you can't all be right, right? Some saw 6, some saw 7, some saw 8, some saw 9. Nobody saw 10. So have another look at it, please. Have another look at it. Okay? Just one more time. Read it. Okay, don't say the answer to anyone beside you. I mean, this has to be one of like the easiest assignments you'll ever see here on campus. Okay? Okay, did you have another look at it? Okay, so let's go through it one more time. How many still see 6? Same 2 people see 6. Okay, how many of you see 7 Fs? Okay, how many see 8? How many see 9? Okay, so the correct answer is 9, right? Okay, so let's count them. Okay, let's go through it. And see the ones that you've missed. Fairness. Fairness. One is the final two result of that's three years of that's four effective 5 and 6 effort 7 and 8 combined with the experience of that's 9 diversity. So which ones were missed? The people who saw 6 or 7 or 8, which ones did you miss? Yeah. Three of them, right? You missed all three of them. Matt proves my point exactly, you know. Matt, same three, the propositions. Okay, why do you think you missed the three ops? Huh? Speed readers. Speed readers. Okay. Other reasons why, you know, even if you counted them, just why would anyone just forget about, yes?
One idea is the F in out is actually a V sound, not an F sound.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a V sound, not an F sound. So that's one reason why people miss it.
Also, in the first line, all of the Fs appear like at the beginning of the word, right? So fairness and final, so the expectation is that the other Fs are going to appear in the front. And if effectively, they're kind of like a second, third,
but
since it's two, it's kind of like
two.
It's hard to miss two.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it sets you up that, you know, it comes in the beginning at the forefront, and you know, the two of them who comes together also very easy to count, but comes to the obs and easily overlooked. Other reasons why people might overlook these Fs. Why? Why do you think?
Well, I don't know. I just went backwards better by that.
Right. Yeah, no, that's good. It's good.
Some of the Fs are mixed in with E's too.
Mm.
And you don't want to call it E and F, so you just...
Yeah. So they are small words, right? You know, people... Human nature is to look at the things that are very much apparent. They seem, you know, the individuals who make a lot of noise and you know, they're easily noticed in groups. But the people who are, you know, the quieter ones, the ones that don't make as much noise, maybe the poor ones. Or the ones that don't have as much talent as other people. These are the ones that are just easily missed out by the majority. They are different, yes, there's a sound, a V sound, not an F sound. So that's, you know, anyone, and this is human nature, like this is not something that we did on purpose here. We just easily overlook the individuals or, you know, the characters who don't matter the most in our lives, and we can just easily forget about them. And here comes, you know, the idea of our topic today, because Christ was a master at pointing out the disenfranchised and the people who no one cared about and the outcasts. And if you look at the core of his teaching, it was basically about these two things, love for God and love for neighbor. So when you look at all the scriptures, you can come up with 1,000 different examples, whether it's the Samaritan woman, whether it's the chaos, whether it was the sinners or the outcast of any kind. These were the ones that he wanted to hang out the most with, and he gave them so much attention because the mainstream society just, you know, quietly overlooked them and passed on and went along with their business. The idea here, if you want to look at it in a contemporary sense, when I say the name Billy Graham, what jumps out at you?
What?
Evangelism, evangelists, yeah. You know, sorry? Crusades, and you have the whole concept of believe in your heart and confess with your mouth and, you know, surrender your life to Christ. And basically there is a focus on love for God, right? What about when I say the name Mother Teresa? What jumps out at you? Compassion and... Sorry?
Humility.
Serving others. You know, dedicating your life other people quietly without, you know, so much talk. So if we want to summarize the topic that we want to discuss tonight, is basically the marriage of Billy Graham and Mother Teresa. Which is in a way impossible, because Mother Teresa has already passed on to a better life and Billy Graham is... But the two concepts, or their legacies, it's the marriage of their legacies together, is basically the ideal way for a Christian to live her or his life. And this is basically what Christ has taught us. It's the marriage between the love of God and having a deep love and infatuation and dedication to God and His Word, but also not being selfish in the sense that we need to remember also those who are less fortunate and not to overlook them. The theme verse that we are looking at tonight, which I would kindly ask someone if you can see, if you have good eyesight, you can read it for us kindly, please. Of course.
Asked him a question, testing him and saying, "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment of the law?" Jesus says to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets."
So basically, why this verse? Because it starts out with a question from a lawyer, right? And this might be a bit relevant to most of you, as you know, having an inquisitive mind, and you know, you really want to run after answers and want to know the truth. You want to get to the bottom of things. But this question actually was a trick question. It wasn't asked in you know, in a way where this particular individual really wanted to know. But he wanted to trick Christ into giving the wrong answer, but Christ was a lot more smarter than him at this particular moment. And he told him, look in your own books, or in that case, the Old Testament, and you figure it out yourself. What does it say? And he basically told him that these are the great two pillars of faith, love for God and love for neighbor. Now, let's try to investigate this a little bit further. And I need your help here, because I know you have a million and one lectures every day, so I don't want this to be like another boring lecture. I want it to be like a dialogue. I want your input into the discussion as much as possible. So let's see, if Christ said, you know, these are the two great pillars that we need to stand on in our lives in general, let's try to unpack that a little bit to understand. What does it mean to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind? And also, if you look at the same verse in Mark 12:30, you find that Mark adds to it also the word of Christ, and with all your strength. So these four areas. So let's try to investigate it a little bit. What is love? Okay, this is just like something very basic. But when we mention the word love, love the Lord your God, what are we referring to here? Yeah, the one you love the most is the one you put on top, takes priority over everything else. Okay? Good. What else? When we say love.
I think it has something to do with, and if you look at 1 Corinthians 13, which defines love, that's a good place to start. Mm-hmm. I guess at the end it says that love hopes and trusts and perseveres, and when we trust with our heart, soul, and mind in God, and when we hope in God, I think that's also loving God.
So entails trust and you know, knowing that He is faithful.
Right.
Yeah. Very good. Okay. Other meanings of love. What does it mean when Christ says, "Love the Lord your God"? Matthew.
faith, trust, that our hopes come true, and that it's not faith, it's honor, and that we sort of trust. But then it's making sort of our love for God, faith, sort of love, just love for something else. It's almost it's like a receptive love, but I love it for others, it often is an outpouring. Often it's a really condition on something for eternity. But with God, we're always receiving.
Yes. So let's say if we take the analogy of two people who are in love, what are they like? Go ahead. Sure. Sure. It's a love that gives, not so much expects to take, even though there is give and take, but there is always the willingness to give. Yes. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, just, I mean, to go on this, it's a similar and a little bit different, too. Jesus, remember, he says in, I think in John, if you love me, you obey my commandments.
Mm-hmm.
And so you wouldn't think of command as a relationship, but it is kind of like that. You just said you want to put them first. You want their wishes are the things you want. For yourself.
And
so it is kind of similar in some way.
Yeah, yeah. Obeying his commandments is a true sign of love, for sure.
I was thinking this on a different line. It's when you love someone, it's your spouse, your parents, your best friend, you're more yourself with them.
Mm-hmm.
You feel the need to pretend to be someone else.
Yeah.
It's a more honest relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you want to be yourself, you want to be at ease. Good. Other signals of love? Right?
Even talk about that,
yeah. Yeah. You want to talk about them to others. You're so proud of this relationship. How about knowing what this person is like? Like, to love God means to know Him. And actually, if you investigate the origins of the word to know in scriptures, means to know intimately, like to be as close, even as like a physical intimacy. So to know God, meaning to know His depth and His heart. And this is what it means to love Him, is to know what He likes and what He doesn't like, and to be as close to Him as, you know, much more than your best friend or much more than anyone that is in your life. To love God means to put Him as a priority. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall have no other gods before me. And then you go into loving Him and being very intimate and close to Him. For God has loved the world to the point that He did what? He gave His only begotten Son. So love also means to sacrifice, meaning that it's not always going to be convenient, our relationship. And there are certain things in His commandments where He will ask us to do and to live by, and to our mind they might not make sense all the time, but because we want to obey and to live in the truth, we want to stick by Him. So now that we understand a little bit what it means to love and to have this agape love, the true and pure and precious love, then He says to love God with all your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. What does it mean to live, to love God with the heart, the soul, the mind, and the strength? And you can comment on any one of them. What does it mean, like practically? And how is that possible? Do you know? Okay. Go ahead, please.
It's just, it cannot give you the whole, in the sense that you know your heart, you know your soul, you know your mind. I mean, everything that is of you, it gives to the person that you love.
Yeah. An all-consuming love. Very beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. Other thoughts. How is that possible? What does it mean? The heart. What does it represent?
I think it's necessary to see the emotions.
Yeah.
I think the look of kind of it's actually like intestines or something, we can really get to heart. And I think the intent was sort of the seed of the emotions and feelings.
Yeah. Yeah, the heart always, you know, it's the center of command that distributes the blood flow to the entire body. And always the heart has, yeah, the symbol of emotions. So these are different dimensions of a human nature where we need to dedicate to God and consecrate to Him. And we tell Him that we love You, Lord, with our heart, meaning the emotions. What about the soul? The soul is more of the psyche, maybe, our psyche. You know, our fears and our anxieties. We are also going to consecrate to Him and tell Him, You are Lord of this compartment in our lives. Our mind, what about our mind? This is the part that gives us a lot of problems sometimes when we feel that maybe we are intellectually higher than God and His Word and His commandments. Right? This is a challenge to us because many of the things that we hear in, you know, could be in school or different teachers, you know, things that, you know, our minds now are higher than God's commandments. And it might make sense to us, but when we dedicate this to Him as well and tell Him, Lord, You are still God of our minds also, no matter what and who says anything, You are still, you know, superior to it.
So it's like there's difference in having reason that's primary for us to use and wield the way we want versus our reason being given over to God.
Yeah.
Saying use this part of my life.
Yeah.
For Your purposes.
Yeah. There's a beautiful verse in the second epistle to the Corinthians where we are laying captive every thought for Christ. Yes, and just read it 1 second. So 2 Corinthians 10:5. Bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. I'll say it once more. Bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. So definitely Christ did give us the reason for, you know, as a part of being created on His own image and likeness. But, you know, using it within, you know, His realm and underneath His supervision. Definitely it has a lot of good. Yeah. Someone had their hands up, but I'm not sure. Go ahead, please.
I was going to go talk about the mind.
Yes.
And we started talking about prepositions at the beginning. Mm-hmm. It says, like, love to work with.
Yeah.
And so, like, with your mind, I think about Paul, who was a tremendous scholar, and I mean, just an expert in so many different languages and the law.
Yeah.
And after his conversion, it wasn't as if God used that part of him, you know. God used his intellect, God used his ability to converse with kings and rulers. And I think that for people in the academy, it's important to recognize that when we come to God, we don't have to check our mind at the door.
Yeah.
Actually, God can use that in a very
powerful
way. It's the ways in which we hone
true.
Our mind, our soul, and our heart so that we can find actively ways to.
Yeah.
I think about C.S. Lewis, who
like sure.
their Christianity,
sure.
and the great thinkers who really use their mental abilities to use
yeah. the gospel. Definitely, fully in agreement with your comment that the only way we are going to reach an intellectual generation is through using our own intellect, but for His glory. And definitely this is something that Paul has done, is that he just converted his mind and his soul and his spirit and his heart and became for God, but he still used all his gifts and talents for His glory. For example, if you look at Acts 17, and his entrance into Athens, he looked at a pagan temple and he said to the people, you are godly people, you are worshippers of a foreign god, and maybe you don't know exactly, but you are godly people. He quoted their philosophers and had discussions with them, and he quoted their poets and all the people from the Hellenist and Greek culture. He was able to relate to them. And at the end of the day, he wants some people for Christ. So definitely I agree with you, you know, using your gifts and talents and intellect and reason, you know, under God's supervision. And there's so much readiness now. You'll be amazed, because pure intellect without God is very dry. And it has no meaning and it has no end to it. But when you add God to the mixture, it all gives it a sense or a survival mode. It's all worth it at the end. But without it, it's just very dry. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, and just like Peter's comment, if you think of Romans 12:1, mm-hmm. it doesn't come that way naturally. It's something that God has to do, because our intellect is fallen. And,
yeah.
You know, somehow twisted like the rest of us. Mm-hmm. Maybe worse, I don't know. But when it's transformed by Christ, it becomes very useful.
Yeah. And there's a need for that renewal in verse 2, you know, to have a renewed mind. Yeah, yeah, a renewed mind is amazing. Yeah. What else? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, the whole body, the whole person, not just a part of it, not just an outwardly, you know, where we say, okay, we're going to go to church or to a meeting, just, you know, to please God and just to, you know, to put him on the shelf for the rest of the week. For example, you know, this is, you know, you've had your part, now it's my time where I go away and live my life away from you. And, you know, we have different divisions in our life. But this beautiful verse gives us a very comprehensive view that, you know, our whole person in our psyche, intellect, emotion, physique, you know, body, mind, strength, soul, heart, all of it is for his glory. And here I want to say that we all need help with, you know, establishing this relationship. It comes through the Holy Spirit, but we need one another. And this is a verse, or this is a phrase. The phrase one another is repeated more than 60 times in the New Testament. To be there for one another and to uphold and to uplift one another and to strengthen one another. And this is what it means to be a community of believers or a church or a congregation of God, where we all are part of the same body and different members, each one having their own gifts and responsibilities for his glory. So here, I want to encourage you, if we are going to truly have this amazing love of God and dedication as the first great commandment, we need one another. And we need, you know, each other's support and prayers, and also the, you know, belonging to a congregation that could be like a source of spiritual nourishment all the time. You know, in every week where we can come together, but also personally, on personal basis, at home, in your room, when you are with a group of friends, just mentioning and remembering the name of God. Now, the second commandment is like it, but it has a little twist to it, which I want to know what you think of it. He says, to love your neighbor as yourself. Are we supposed to, you know, love ourselves? What does it mean? Like, spiritually speaking, like, I mean, he's assuming like we already have this kind of care or attention for ourselves? Or what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? I think many of us have noticed the first half of the verse, which says, love your neighbor. But I don't know if a lot of people give thought to the second half of the verse where they say, as yourself. What does it mean, as yourself, here in this particular context?
I think it's a statement of humility. Insofar as, like, let's say, for example, somebody is at a place where you would like to be, then it could be easy to be very deferential to them,
yeah,
and actually have an inferiority complex where you're like, this person's better than me. And so, in some ways, you don't love yourself as much as you love this person, so that's why there's that disconnect. Or if you look at the reverse side of it, where you think, oh, this person is dressed a certain way or looks a certain way, and so they're not as good as I am, so I shouldn't shake their hand, I shouldn't do X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really like you knowing who you are, and in that sense being humble, then you're able to like relate to people in a godly way.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much. Yeah. I like so much the idea of knowing who you are first and understanding, you know, the whole concept of theology of the person. Being created in the image and likeness of God, this is a starting point. Also understanding the whole concept of the incarnational model, God becoming man or human, in order to help us to have back this image again of holiness and godliness. So being in God's image, Christ humbled himself and became human just to, you know, resemble us. And we are also asked to imitate this particular model. Exactly like you said, Peter. Thank you. The whole concept that I'm created in God's image, but God humbled himself and became one of us. And this will help us to deal with others in the same manner, looking at each individual as being created on the image and likeness of God. And how will I best relate to her or to him is through this incarnational model, knowing who I am and then becoming like everyone else, just like the model of Christ. And this is the amazing concept of loving your neighbor. This is the best way to reach your neighbor, is to become like all, to have love and respect to all without any kind of partiality or difference. Because even says in scriptures, God, even though he was, you know, God Almighty on his throne, he humbled himself. He made this choice. What about us as human beings? We are already human beings. Like, I mean, we are not like God in his heavens and his throne. So I mean, the transition for God is much bigger than just myself becoming humble, just to resemble God. So this is a way to connect the, you know, with others around me, and to understand their fears and their pains and their agonies and their stresses, etc. Can you help to explain a little bit what it means to love one's neighbor? What does it mean? Like, what are we referring to here in this particular context? I mean, it is another great commandment that we are all asked to follow. What does it mean here? Or practically speaking, how is that possible? Go ahead, please.
The story of the Samaritan about what Jesus used to describe how you should love your neighbor. So it means that you are willing to sacrifice yourself, and in that case, your safety, your time, your facilities as well for your neighbor, just as you do for yourself.
Yeah. Just thank you so much. Just being able to pour out from your own time and effort and inconvenience or convenience, you know, even finances sometimes. I mean, the story of the Good Samaritan is one of those amazing stories, because sometimes we can't understand how amazing it is until we understand all the details, what happened exactly, or the historical background. See, Christ gave here a parable or an example, and he said there was this man who was basically a Hebrew or from the Jewish religion, and he was traveling, and then some thieves came upon him and they gave him a good beating, so they left him between alive and dead. Right now, his own countrymen passed by him. Now they have the law, and they have the traditions, and basically they were individuals of respect in the community. One was a priest and one was a Levi, and basically they looked at this man. Why didn't they help him? Do you know why they never helped him? Yes. Exactly. They were not allowed to touch his corpse. They thought he was dead. That's why they, and because if they were to touch a corpse, then they would themselves would be defiled, and then they had to go through all these process of just purification, and they have to stay away from other people, and they have to say that they were defiled, etc. And it's you know, they didn't want to risk it. This is what the law and the command said, and we're just going to stick by it. That's it. But Christ condemned them because they knew the law, but they didn't have the spirit or the heart of the law. Which one was more important at that moment? To save a person's life, who is between life and death? Or just to say, you know, I will be defiled for a week and I won't be able to have dinner with my family, for example, right? Which one was more important? I mean, it is a risk that he condemned them for, that they were able to memorize and to know all the details, but they didn't have the compassion or the heart to back it up. So came along this Samaritan. Now, what was the problem with the Samaritans? Or what was the, you know, the, why weren't they getting along? The Jews and the Samaritans, historically speaking.
They intermarried, so with
history in terms of religious practice as well. Yeah, very. Are you a history major by any chance, or just out of interest? Because you're saying the answer is right on exactly. They intermarried with the nations. Basically, the history of Israel and Judea. Okay, if you know after you know the time of the Exodus and you know the time passed by the time of Solomon, there was a division. Okay, where the southern kingdom was called Judea, and then the northern kingdom was called Israel. And there was a captivity in the northern kingdom of Israel in the year 722 BC. And this captivity was to Assyria. And you know what's the capital of Assyria? It's Nineveh. Okay, so you know the story of Jonah, of course, etc. So Nineveh was the capital city of Assyria. So the northern kingdom fell captives to Assyria. And then they returned after a while. But when they returned, they had intermarried with the nations or with the Gentiles. So people who were not necessarily of a Jewish heritage or background. So they were, you know, according to their customs, they had mixed blood between a Gentile and a Jew. So, and also they had strayed away because they couldn't worship in Jerusalem. And you know the story from the Samaritan woman in John 4. And they had their own mountain and they had their own well, etc. Where they had just the religious practices away from the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem. So there was this enmity between them. Yes, they were sort of cousins, the Samaritans and the Judeans at this time. But they weren't really in full communion together. So there comes this stranger and he's passing along. And according to the Hebrew children, the Israelites, the Jews, right? This is an enemy. Okay, these are bad people. They have, you know, messed up our rituals of worship and prayer. They don't worship with us. They intermarried with the nations. All of these things. But who was the one who was willing to help? It was the stranger, and not necessarily the one who had the commandments and the law. So here comes the whole idea of the neighbor. Who is the neighbor? Who was the true neighbor at this particular time? The Lord asked, and he said, the true neighbor was the one who had compassion in their heart. Acts of mercy, basically they are mentioned here in Matthew 25, 34 to 36, so we can ask someone to read them for us. Can you see the screen?
Yeah.
Please.
Come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me.
So these are what we call the acts of mercy and of compassion. And then they asked, you know, when did we ever do this to you? He said, you know, whenever you do these acts of mercy to the least of my brethren, you have done them unto me. Now, here I want to mention the concept of love to God, love to neighbor, as leaders of the next generation in America, possibly all over the world. Some of you will, you know, will be the senators or the presidents, or may God bless all your, you know, aspirations for the future. Some people say, well, I just have this job, or I'm doing it as a job. And some people feel the fact that you're only called into ministry, only if you're into full-time ministry, this is God's calling to you. But we want to purify this idea of a calling to understand that each and every one of us is being called from God into this particular place that you are working in. And you don't look at it as work, but you look at it as a vocation, as a calling, as a ministry, where you are going to be practicing, you know, what you had studied for and prepared all your life for. This is a calling from God. He placed you there for a specific reason, to witness to Him and to fulfill your ministry. Now, an author by the name of Hunter, he said the following: work has lost any spiritual and eternal significance. It is important only insofar as it fosters certain qualities of the personality. It is only about gaining wealth. So again, we need to put some more depth into it. As you are preparing, hopefully, to graduate soon and to go into the world. It's not just going to be about paying bills or about being you know, the elite amongst the society. It's about love of God, love of neighbor, and really understanding the demographics of God's calling unto you in the place where you are. When God commanded us to glorify Him in our vocation and in our work, He did the same thing too. He gave significance to work by saying, as in John 5:17, My Father works until now, and I also work. So by God Himself referring to His actions in the world as work, He is putting this significance and understanding that it's not just a mere action or a physical outwardly action, it is actually a calling. I must work the works of Him who sent me. Even Christ on earth, you know, did God's work. And this doesn't necessarily mean for all of us is to be into full-time ministry, but it is a calling to anywhere that we're at. Christ also continued by saying, I have glorified you on earth. And thus we can see the marriage here between work, the work that God has given Him to do, and doing it all for God's glory. How do we do that? And this is going to be a challenge. And it's not going to be easy. And, you know, we fully understand, you know, the concepts of being politically correct. And we're not against any of it. But it is through our conduct, through our ethical behavior and moral behavior. And any opportunity to witness to God and to say, well, this is the reason that I'm doing what I'm doing. It's not just, you know, for the sake of whatever. This is because of my ethics and my belief system that I have chosen to follow. Let me assure you that in this day and age, there is so much openness for God's work in people's lives. It's amazing, really. Like when Matt, unfortunately, picked me up from the airport today, and he really wanted to see someone else, but he's the only one who was, I guess, free. So he ended up picking me up. Again, life is not perfect, but you know, we were riding the bus. You know, he's a big spender. And took me for a nice tour. And, you know, he really wanted to show me like the subway system in Boston. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed the experience. Exactly. So, but it was really amazing because you know why? A guy just very randomly came up to us, you know, and he asked, you know, can you pray for me for this reason? And, you know, I'm going through these issues. And really, it was a good opportunity just, you know, to pray with someone in the bus as we were riding the bus. And isn't that amazing? And sometimes we think that, you know, today's world, everyone is just afraid from the name of God. And, you know, just to say that this is my belief, etc. But God opens doors in amazing ways. And we as His agents and His stewards should be open to accepting His word. Also, it's important as we speak about, you know, how to love God and how to love neighbor, never to forget the Sabbath day, your rest, your day of rest. Because you're going to be so busy with a million and one things to do all the time. But it's really important to set aside in the midst of your busy schedule just a time for rest and a time to remember God in the midst of your busy schedule. And here I'd like to share with you just a little poem, if you allow me, please. And it says the following. I do not know how long I'll live, but while I live, Lord, let me give some comfort to someone in need, by smile or nod, kind word or deed. And let me do whatever I can to ease things for my fellow man. I want not but to do my part, to lift a tired or weary heart. To change folks' frowns to smiles again, then I would not have lived in vain. And I'll not care how long I'll live if I can give and give and give, written by B.J. Morbitzer. And I just want to warn you towards the end of this discussion of this verse, because we are living in a tough generation and it's going to swamp you with, you know, so many different things. And Christ said it in Matthew 24, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold, but he who endures to the end shall be saved. We have to be very careful. We're living in very cold countries here, and I come from Toronto, that is even colder than down here. And because of lawlessness, you know, our love for God becomes frozen. We have no emotions anymore. We become like machines where we just go to work and do the things we have to do. And then what does it amount to at the end? But the presence of these two things in our life will make it all worthwhile at the end. Love for God, having a very strong spiritual touch and contact with Him, but also helping others around us. And by the way, I just read in the media last week a very interesting article that says, finally they discovered that money can bring happiness. And this is the title, right? And everyone, how? He said, when you give it to others.
Right.
When you share it with others. Really, people are very joyful when they are, you know, able to share things with, not necessarily monetary, but in any sense, through service or help. But at the end, I'd like to ask the question. Now, I want to go to the other presentation. There's another one that's open here. If you can, life. Yeah, can you just... No, let me just go down one bit. Yeah. I'm going to ask a very silly question, like the one I asked in the beginning. You know, the one about counting 1 to 10? Now you're armed and ready, huh, to count the F's. Except this exercise is not about counting F's. It's another silly question about how do you spell the word life? Right? But you're going to say this is very silly because we already have the correct spelling on the screen in front of us, right? Wrong. Because many people spell the word life differently. And here are some examples. Some people spell the word life L-I-F-E. So they live their life with a big focus on the word, on the letter I. These are the egocentric people. People who live their lives only focusing on themselves. And they don't care about others. Not, it's all about me. No one else matters. Even if I see the agony of people around me, I don't care. If people are in need, I don't care. I will step on other people to, you know, reach success, that's fine. As long as I only have myself. It's me, myself, and I. It's, you know, that's all that matters. Family, friends, God, religion, ethics, morals, that's all irrelevant as long as I have, you know, I am what matters at the end. And unfortunately, this is a very challenging and difficult way of spelling the word life. Here's the second way that some people spell it. L-I-F-E, which shows the word lie, living a big lie, right? Because you're living a life which is not yourself. And of course, in the field of law, it's all about truth and honesty. But sometimes it may appear so in the outwardly, but deep inside it's different because I don't have a full satisfaction, right? Nothing in the world has satisfied me. So I'm just living a big lie. Yes, I seem in front of the people that I'm the happiest person. You know, I'm the life of the party. And when I'm there, everyone is having fun. When I'm not there, everyone is just, you know, bored and sitting in the corner, right? But you go and you speak to this individual and they find that they are very much down and stressed and despair and depression. And I'm not saying that, you know, these are all, of course, you know, medical conditions, and I fully respect that, but I mean, some people don't have the joy inside of them. They're just feeling that, you know, it's something from, it's all outwardly where people see me and they praise me, you know, I'm the best person who ever lived, but deep inside I don't have any kind of satisfaction. And unfortunately, after living a long time, I find like I'm living a big lie. The third way that some people spell the word life is the word L? Oh, you guessed it, huh? you're way ahead of us here. So if, right? L-I-F-E, if. Because after a while, you remember back and you say, if I had done it a different way when I was younger, I wouldn't have been in so much problems or troubles. I would have made my life really count. If, you know, I had listened to, you know, the advice that I received from this individual, or if I had noticed that I was on the wrong path, I could have corrected my path a long time ago. And this is why God puts for us different, you know, means and circumstances and individuals where we can just hear His voice and try to focus on Him and on Him alone. The best way to spell the word life is as follows, right? Living, it's a dancing life a little bit. living life to its fullest. And that means really the two great commandments that God has given us. And each and every one of you resembles in a way the life of Joseph in the Old Testament, where he was successful in terms that he became, you know, the second man after Pharaoh. But at the same time also he said, how can I commit this great sin and sin against God? And he had a spiritual awakening in his heart. So he had this balance, and he helped his family and he helped his country people, and he was a great blessing to the entire land of Egypt. But also he had a deep dedication for his faith, and this is a life that is worth living. So may God bless you all, and it was a pleasure seeing you, and I will be praying for you, and I also ask you to pray for me. And we don't know where or when we're going to meet again, but we are still in the same body of Christ, connected. No matter where we are still connected together through our faith. Thank you so much. If you have any questions or comments, it is my my pleasure. Close it down. Definitely, in giving, we also take. There is no doubt in that. Just a few years ago, we had like a service trip to Africa, to Kenya, and we were the ones who were coming from North America, supposedly, you know, people having all the good stuff to give. But the simple people who came to us, they had amazing gifts to present to us. Two chicken eggs. Some vegetables and peas and things like that, like from their garden. And these people were giving us with all their heart, like, you know, the example of the widow who gave the 2 mites from her needs. This is what these people were giving, like we were giving from our excess, or, you know, the things that had no more use in our cupboards, and, you know, the excess. But these people really, we felt that they were giving all their livelihood with so much compassion and love. And then you go and you sit with them, and you know how joyful they are in the Lord in their singing and their praise and their worship. It was really uplifting. And you know, at the end of our trip, we all asked ourselves, who was going to serve who? Really, we are the ones who got served, definitely. Because we are the ones who gained the most out of this experience. We came back focused, came back knowing, you know, our technology and our books are not the only source of joy in the world, but you know, really, the joy of the Lord is your strength, really. This is what these people taught us and showed us by living example. Yeah. Go ahead, please.
I think one thing that comes up from the story of the Good Samaritan that also comes up a lot throughout the Gospels and Paul's letters too, is the idea of you can't believe, on one hand, you can't believe for us to advise another person. It's good for us to be out and talking to people who may not have the same standards as we are, living different lives, maybe doing things that we wouldn't be doing that, you know, they may be living a way that's impure, but we should be spending time with them too.
Mm.
Whereas on the other hand, you know, if you're a recovering alcoholic, you should be hanging out with people who are doing, you know, stuff that could contaminate you. That actually could have effect on your behavior, that, you know, the Levite and the priest were passing by that they were concerned about. And I think there's, to me, there's kind of a line you need, or not even a line to draw, but it kind of seems to keep in mind. And I feel like, you know, they drew it in the wrong place.
Yeah.
They clearly didn't work way their priorities right way. But in terms of balancing being among people who are living a different sort of life to share with them, I mean, how would you kind of rate those concerns?
Well, I view God as giving us or asking us to have some sort of a holistic life, not just to focus on one area and neglect everything else. And I find the virtue of wisdom and discernment is really important with every other virtue that we are trying to acquire. So, you know, we cannot just strip these two verses from the Bible and just forget about, you know, the 500,000 other words in the Bible, right? It all comes together. So, I mean, everyone should know their limits and their, you know, what their gifts and talents. Like, it's impossible, like, to say, well, this is how everyone should be. Like, we're all closed down within this box because we're all created differently. So, you may have gifts that I don't have, and I may have that you don't have, and the body of Christ fulfills the entire image together. So this is the concept that we are not standing alone. So it's not like an individual thing where everyone necessarily needs to be the whole body. No, the eye needs to be the eye, and the arm needs to be the arm. And then together we make up the perfect image of what God is asking us to do. So there's no problem in saying, well, you know, my limits are that I can help, you know, a homeless person, but I can't help a person who's drunk, for example. And then Peter will come and say, well, you know, I see that God gave me the tolerance or the ability to help a drunker person, but really I can't help the other person. And then Matthew comes and says, I have no talents whatsoever, so I'm not really sure what I can do. So it's like, you know, hanging. I'm sorry, Matthew. I have to pick on someone. But, you know, just putting it together, then you have the whole body, which is great in the sight of God. Any other comments or questions? You good? The word Abuna? Yeah, just father. Father, yeah. Pastor, priest. God bless you. All the best to you. Thank you. Thank you. The smartness. Thank you so much. Pleasure seeing you. And
my wife Erin's giving a concert.
It's a CD release party, so if you come, you can get a CD. It's in Inman Square, so it's, you know, where Christina's Ice Cream or 1369 Coffee Shop. It's just right up here on Cambridge Street.
Yeah, I can put the details on the website.
Okay.
And then, if you went to the admin service, you heard Erin saying, and she's awesome. And if you haven't heard her sing, then there'll be a link on the website to her MySpace page. And it was great. Like, I was commenting out last night, but I was playing like the songs over and over again, and it was great.
And then Saturday is dinner discussion. Tomorrow is the dinner discussion. Social justice is the topic. We're going to have meat and vegetarian chili and cornbread and desserts.
Anyone have anything else they want to share with the group? Anything else going on? Meat, discussion, fun? Okay. Well, then, I guess that's your all. Off we go.
It's very much a pleasure to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.